Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon. The first time that Tom Hanks came on our show was to talk about a movie he'd made based on a Dave Eggers novel called Hologram for the King, and now he's gone and made The Circle, another film that's based on a Dave Eggers book. It's about a company with utopian ideals that morphs into something that's kind of disturbing. It also stars Emma Watson, Patton Oswalt, the late Bill Paxton, and Glenn Headley. James Ponsoldt co-wrote and directed it, and I am thrilled that both Tom Hanks and James Ponsoldt could join us now. Welcome to our show.
Thanks. Good to be back. Good to be billed as America's sweetheart. I can't thank you enough.
What is it with you and Dave Eggers?
He captures a zeitgeist that that between something as very specific as that memoir, which was a heartbreaking work of staggering genius, and the two books that I read and immediately said, well, this is a movie. All we have to do is, you know, cut and paste some of the pages that we have. You know, have what we want. There is a bizarre reality that goes along with everything. The life that, for the first one, Hologram for the King, the life that he describes in Saudi Arabia is unrecognizable to anybody that has not been to Saudi Arabia, but then is so constructed by rules that, well, as soon as you adopt this kind of odd logic, you can follow. Likewise, with The Circle, May, who is played by Emma Watson, walks into a place where the rules as we know it do not apply, but once you acquiesce to them, the world is made out for you in a perfect order that establishes happiness.
This is darker than Hologram for the King.
It is, because it flirts with the idea that someone in power is making an awful lot of money by promoting the idea that humanity is perfectible. It seems a lot of people will pay to be let in on that scheme.
James, are you also a fan of David Eggers' work?
Yeah, Heartbreaking Worker, Staggering Genius came out when I was in college, and it rocked me, and I just read everything that he wrote after that, and sort of I feel like, you know, the way that he was engaging with culture, I think he was speaking to me and my peers. So I was very excited when The Circle came out.
And Tom said that when he read it, he saw it immediately as a film. Is this the kind of book that just says I can be adapted without too much trouble?
It captures the imagination, and May, sort of as a surrogate, I think, for the reader or the audience watching the film, captures the imagination because she, I think, exemplifies the best and perhaps worst in us in the way that we relate to technology. But, I mean, the book, when I read it, I found it darkly hilarious, and he built an entire world, which I could see, but it really haunted me. It terrified me.
How supportive was Eggers during the scriptwriting process?
Incredibly supportive. Dave, from the very beginning, one of the first conversations we had, you know, he said that his favorite sort of book to screen adaptations were ones that were true, perhaps in theme, but also invented where they needed to. And you know, books and films are different mediums, and he was just a wonderful collaborator throughout.
Foolishly so, almost. It's like, Dave, are you sure? Because we're going to monkey around with this thing. Surprisingly, the first time I met him, I said, you are such a genius for never allowing Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius to be adapted into a film. Bravo for that. But now we're just trying to twist him out of the idea of letting his books be turned into movies.
Many filmmakers have said that the best thing to turn into a movie is a short story. Because a novel just has too many different things happening in it, and you have to sacrifice things or compress things.
Yeah, I mean, in this case, a novel is necessarily a big, unwieldy collection of ideas and plot threads, and, you know, this book in its own way, you know, has so many sort of Dickensian threads. And so, yeah, that we necessarily had to sort of consolidate and get rid of some characters and plot threads, but we felt like, you know, if we were experiencing this story through the lens of May and her personal struggles, that that would help focus what we were going to, you know, engage with in the film.
When you were writing the script, did you already have the backing of a studio?
No.
It doesn't work that way anymore, Leonard.
It doesn't?
Not really, no. No.
You mean you don't think about the money until after you have a completed script?
Well, it's not like some – there's executives out there that have a company in which they're controlling the Eggers universe like some of the other more popular franchises that are out there. You just take a shot. You just I think the rule of thumb now with an awful lot of the motion picture business as well as TV is the only thing you can do is make sure that it's good, and that starts on paper. And from that, that's actually a marketable and bankable enterprise.
Were you already thinking about Tom as Eamon Bailey when you were writing this?
I was in my wildest fantasies because Tom's been my favorite actor for pretty much as long as I've been watching
movies.
I am
America's sweetheart.
I mean, I told him this early on. I mean, big.
You're not going to let me forget
I'm
that.
Not. No. I thought I graduated to America's dad. But listen, I should be flattered by sweetheart.
He's America's most trusted sweetheart is what he is. But big,
which, of course, is an important part of this role because we kind of trust Tom Hanks sometimes. It's kind of like the way we used to trust Jimmy Stewart. And so when there's a dark side to the character, then that becomes a bit complicating.
Well, what I was fascinated by was that very trick, is that I don't think Eamon Bailey says a single untrue thing in the course of this whole movie, right down to the moment where the ghost is given up. Even then, he says something that is quite frankly, relatively profoundly true. So you don't have an argument against anything that he says, but you are repulsed by everything that he stands for.
Did you see him as someone like Steve Jobs or Mike Zuckerberg?
I actually saw him as more... I saw him as somebody that had less faith in technology, but more faith in the human condition than I think that those two guys have.
Well, you have another character here who actually plays the darker role, the money man, Tom Stenton.
Yeah.
Patton
Oswalt plays him. So you could play that off of the Eamon Bailey character.
Yeah, they're sort of flip sides, perhaps, of the same impulse. Stenton certainly makes the company work and is interested in the bottom line because for all of the utopian sort of social justice-oriented neo-hippie ideals of Eamon, the company has to be profitable.
So we've been circling around it. Would either of you like to describe what the circle is?
Sure. I mean, the circle is a story about a young woman named May, played by Emma Watson.
In a deadbeat job.
She's stuck in a job that she's not, you know, she's a couple years out of college.
Works for the county.
She works for the county, Department of Water and Power. She's a millennial, not passionate, but feels like she has a... She should be doing something more important with her life. She lives with her parents. You know, one of her parents has a chronic illness, and then she sort of gets a lifeline thrown to her from an old college friend to get an interview with the Circle. And the Circle is a company 5 minutes in the future that would have subsumed all of its competitors. And then that dream job becomes sort of a religion for her, which then almost becomes a cult of a glass prison of celebrity.
It is the greatest company to work for on the planet.
And what is its goal?
Its goal is if you took Google, well, its mission is to force everybody to use the Circle and be a member of the Circle. If you took Google and Facebook and Apple and Twitter, put them all together and put them on the road to absolute complete total monopoly of everything that goes online in the world, because as soon as that happens, of course, everything will work fine.
And it seems like the kind of place everybody would want to work at because everyone is remarkably friendly, supportive. The company compound is like a campus where everything you could ever think of is available.
It's based on WNYC. So of course, right here.
I'm excited for the free massages and yoga later. It is a wonderful place to work. It is a place where all of your needs are met, where sort of why would you need to leave on the weekends if there's free concerts, free yoga, free healthcare, free food, all of your friends are there. It's all to serve the consumer better and makes the lives of the people that work there great.
There's a moment early in the film, which is my favorite line, where May has gone off and she's gone kayaking by herself and she hasn't posted any aspect of what she did over the weekend. And one of her coworkers says, "But I like kayaking too," which means that you had an anonymous moment to yourself, but I didn't get to share that with you. That right there is kind of like the dynamic that it sets up.
And then there is at one point where Eamon asks May, "If you're being observed, do you think that you'd behave better than if you're alone?" Which leads us, of course, to
there's a story in the New York Times today in China how, you know, cameras are keeping watch on all of the students somewhere. And yes, what is that?
Well, not just the students, but also the teachers. It's everyone in they're streaming classes in order to see the behavior of the students and the teachers.
I'm not smart enough to know what that principle is. What is it called? That thing that because you're observing something, it automatically changes.
The Heisenberg uncertainty principle is what it is. And we've seen it in action, right? I mean, I think during the height of the Cold War, the Stasi, the East German secret police, collected more data on its citizens than ever had been collected in history, and roughly a third of the country were informants for the government. So in any situation like this with three people sitting around a table, one of us was informant of the government, so everyone was on best behavior.
And when you started reading news reports recently, there have been a couple of murders on Facebook. Did you think, oh, gee, we were ahead of this curve?
The events that...
Not that you want those things to happen.
No, I mean, they're absolutely tragic for the victims and the victims' families. And, a lot of these new platforms, they give a voice to people. We know the good side of that. It's, giving voice to the voiceless, connection, but also there can be hugely negative ramifications that sort of beg the question of what's the ethical responsibility, what's the culpability of the companies that are creating these platforms.
I'm speaking with James Ponsoldt, who co-wrote with Dave Eggers, directed The Circle. It's based on Dave Eggers' novel of the same name. It opens this Friday and premieres at the Tribeca Film Festival tonight at 8:45. It will also be shown there tomorrow at 5:45. He's here. It's Tom Hanks is the star of the film. It's Eamon Bailey. By the way, if you want more ticket information, you can go to our show page at wmyc.org/lowpate. We will continue our conversation after this. And we are back with Tom Hanks and James Ponsoldt talking about a new film called The Circle. And anyone who rides New York City's subways has seen lots of posters for it. So obviously somebody thinks that this is a movie that should be promoted. It's going to get a lot of attention.
I hope so. I mean, I think the issues in the film, what's central to it is, it's not a technophobic film. Like, there's so much great technology in our lives. I met my wife, for what it's worth, through Facebook, and sending people to outer space, exploring the bottom of the sea, understanding the human mind, curing cancer, these are great things. I think the questions that the film asks, though, is why do these same companies have to monitor us and hold our information and perhaps monetize it?
Yeah, why is their business model based on world domination? That's the question I have. Why do they only truly succeed when there are no other competitors that offer their services?
But then we have these things that come along and they look like they're going to take over the world, and then a new technology just eliminates them.
Yeah, so, I love the current kind of like death battle that's going on between Snapchat and everybody else in social media.
Yeah, I mean, I think at this moment there is an unprecedented accumulation of power, money, and information, which equals power with various companies in Silicon Valley. And I don't think it's in the best interest of these companies to self-regulate or break themselves up. So I'm curious to see what happens.
Although your movies tend to be quite different, they all, from The End of the Tour to The Spectacular Now, feature people who are kind of clueless and are trying to find out who they are. Much like May, who goes through a remarkable journey here from someone who revels in kayaking alone to being hooked up electronically all the time. Is that a theme that's important to you?
I think I relate to characters most in their fallibility. I try not to judge a character. I want to understand them, and I want to you know, through the process of the film, maybe confront their fears, which are probably my fears, and their addictions, which might be my addictions. I certainly love all of the screens in my life.
And the seductive quality of these addictions. May is a bit diffident about being online all the time at first, but when her parents are offered insurance that they can't afford, that becomes a turning point for her.
I mean, I think what she's, you know, I think I most relate to her in her most vulnerable and lowest moments. That, you know, she is idealistic and wants to make her mark, but she also perhaps lacks the spine to define boundaries with people around her. She says yes, which is a good thing, but she also feels like she owes a part of herself to everyone that wants a part of it, which is something that that I you know, when I think about my kids who are very young and the future that they're going to inherit and how they will relate to technology and their personal boundaries and it, you know, the way that they think about privacy, I hope that they're strong enough to say no.
The movie puts forward, Eggers puts forward this concept of transparency in our lives, is that all of us seem to be voluntarily becoming less, more and more transparent, less and less private by what we post about ourselves and where we are and what we're doing. And he posits the idea that, well, if you are an elected official in the United States of America, wouldn't it be the most perfect status for that person to be completely transparent so we know what they're doing, saying, who they're meeting with 100% of the time? And if it's good for them, wouldn't it be good for everybody to no longer have secrets and therefore there would be no shame because everybody knows everybody's other secrets and what's the big deal? That's a slippery slope in every way, shape, and form. And yet it seems to be something that people are voluntarily co-opting into.
If you use your company's email, your company has access to anything you have ever written as an email message or received as an email message. So we really have given up a lot of our privacy, and now the Senate has just given away a bit more about privacy.
Yeah, there you go. I like one of the most damning emails you could have on record would be this: call me on a hard line. what went on in that conversation you had on that hard line? Why did you ask that person to call you on a hard line?
Tom, what's it like to go back and forth between directors you're familiar with, Robert Zemeckis, Ron Howard, and then someone you've never worked with before? Does he operate quite differently?
He does, indeed. What I have with the directors I've worked with before is a shorthand, so we spend absolutely no time having to get to know each other. But what comes along with working with someone like James is this whole other perspective of what a work process is. And it ends up being extremely invigorating because you never, ever stop learning new tricks.
We're very sad to learn today about the passing of a director you worked with.
Yeah, Jonathan Demme.
What was he like? You won your first Academy Award for Philadelphia, which you directed.
When you worked with Jonathan, it was like working with the most popular adjunct professor in your college. His heart was in absolutely every aspect of making the movie, from how the movie production was staffed, who he worked with. He put forward a veritable UN of skin tone and backgrounds on films and listened to absolutely every perspective that was given. The end result was a very, almost like a, if I'm using the word properly, an ecumenical filmmaking experience. His loss, I mean, he made movies that were just pure unadulterated fun. I mean, even Silence of the Lambs had this perspective of it that was stretching the boundaries of a relationship between an audience and a filmmaker. But he had with him a sense of human responsibility to how he conducted himself and how he made his living that taught me a very important lesson at a time where I was primed to learn it.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to interview Jonathan almost 10 years ago for Rachel Getting Married, and I've always admired his films. He's made some of my favorites. And
he's been a guest on our show a number of times.
I asked how he worked with actors, if he could sort of distill it down, and he said, yeah, I let them do anything they want in front of the camera. Anything, if we've done a bunch of takes, they want to do another one, of course we're going to do it. I just ask that they do anything, you know, that I ask of them. And sounds like there's just a deep foundation of trust and respect between collaborators, which is something I certainly aspire to.
He would make this announcement: no acting allowed.
But a number of people have told me that the real trick to success in theater and film is casting. And so you was Tom the first person you had in mind? Because this, you have a pretty terrific cast here. Emma Watson is perfect. People recognize Ella Coltrane from Boyhood as the antithesis to the Circle movement. And then this is the last film that Bill Paxton was in.
God, yeah, it's been a brutal couple of few months here.
Yeah, I mean, Tom can talk about Bill more eloquently than I can. I can only say that in working with Bill on this film, I was just so deeply inspired by the generosity that he brought, you know, to the set. He understood everybody's job because he was a filmmaker as well. He brought out the best in the actors around them and was just unbelievably kind and present.
Bill was this kind of like goofy cowboy in one way from Fort Worth, and yet he collected impressionistic paintings and turned me on to impressionists that I had no idea of. He was a constant fan of it. He just assumed his enthusiasms were your enthusiasms, and it came out in a physical way in that he had no sense of the sphere of influence that Americans have, is that we would get very uncomfortable when anybody gets closer than 14 inches to us. Mm. Bill would stick his face in yours 6 inches away and say, buddy, can you believe we're getting a crack at this material? He was just a fantastic artist in every way, director, writer. He did it all. And for a guy who started off as the swing shift, you know, set coordinator or set decorator, he was a great, great force.
And you worked together on Apollo 13?
Apollo 13. And we did some off-camera work together as well.
He was also a really great guest. I rate people according to how good they were as a guest. Right, I don't care what they do when they're out of the studio. They could be the most awful person in the world. But
that's why we're on our best behavior.
Yeah, that's why, then. And that's why you guys are here. Now, but his character in the film is a lot sicker than he must have been during the shoot.
Yeah, I mean, he was, and Bill, you know, brought such attention to detail and wanted to bring out the honesty and the illness of the character. But, yeah, I mean, Bill was...
His character suffers from muscular...
MS.
Yeah. MS, multiple sclerosis.
Yeah, MS. But, yeah, I mean, Bill, you know, I was with him a week before he passed away. We were doing ADR, and, you know, when we were just talking about filmmaking.
ADR is?
Additional dialogue recording for the film. And, you know, we were talking about composers, about Danny Elfman, who's the wonderful composer who did the score for our film. And, you know, Bill was texting me that same night, which was his nature, I would assume, about what was on Turner Classic Movies, about some obscure noirs. He was just passionate and, you know, a real film lover.
Now, I did... How much of the film is pre-shot in your head, and when? How much improvising occurs on the set?
I mean, I think you design. You know, you have a script, which is a blueprint. You know, which gets everyone roughly on the same page, and then there's a collaboration between different artists, the production designer, the costume designer, the cinematographer,
and different actors approach their roles differently.
Of course, everyone has a different you know, methodology, and I would never sort of impose my way of working on someone else. If, you know, Tom, I've seen the results of Tom's process. I don't understand his process exactly, but I know the results. So I just want to be a facilitator and support actors that I love and whose imaginations I respect.
We all trust that if it is really lousy, you won't use it.
Yeah.
Which is actually a very liberating thing.
A number of actors have told me that they thought the best scene they shot wound up on the cutting room floor.
Oh, that's too subjective. They're probably out of their minds.
You also had to deal with making real the intrusive nature of postings and all the people who crowd our lives, even though they're not physically around us.
Yeah, there's...
That's a harder thing to do visually.
There are. They're in Dave's book, there are what are called zings, and after May goes what is called transparent, once she starts wearing a camera and has an audience, there's sort of a Greek chorus of strangers who comment on every aspect of her life. And we wanted to visually represent that Greek chorus, almost treated as pop art that, you know, comes in every language written, and that sort of ran the gamut from people who are genuinely funny to people who think they're funny to the mundane to the random to the kind of creepy. And, you know, we wanted to represent essentially visually Walla, like too much information for anyone to take in, including May.
So did you think of this as a comedy?
I think of it as a dark comedy. Yeah, I mean, I do. I think there's something absurdist and satirical, certainly in Dave's book, and I hope the film possesses that spirit as well.
There's a moment where May says, "We sent over a million frowns to that government, and I'm sure that's going to change their their policy." Now, that's funny.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to throw stones at people who are just like youthful and idealistic and write them off as being naive. I think a lot of the characters in the film do come off as that, the difference being between them and a sophomore in college, they have billions of dollars to impose their will.
Now, Tom, a lot of actors wind up also wanting to direct. You seem to want to be a guest host. What was it like to do Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Something for Peter Sagan?
Well, you mean, I roared my way into NPR's weekends. I will have to say that if someone held a gun to my head and forced me to choose, I don't get to do this anymore. I have to take on some other job. Give me that four-day gig on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. You hang around with very, very funny people for 3.5 days, and then you put on a hilarious show in which you don't have to learn any lines that night. I'm a big fan of an awful lot of stuff that's on NPR, but Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is not even a guilty pleasure. It's just
misinterpreted. I thought it was a dress rehearsal for when you might be doing a guest stint on our show.
Oh, I think I'm such a good actor. I could fake my way through your show, Leonard. I think I could maybe do that.
I do every day.
Oh, nonsense.
Did you have fun on So Many White Guys, the podcast?
That was actually intriguing because, I'm 60 years old. I had never heard of the podcast So Many White Guys. So I was just saying, I'll talk to her. I must say the questions were kind of, they were tests. I had not pondered an awful lot of what was put towards me on that show.
And, James, you're going to be tackling your first major studio film for Disney called Wild City. How far along is that?
I've been writing the script, yeah. I mean, it's, be live action with visual effects in the way that Jungle Book was. It's about
a CG live action.
Yeah, it's about a mountain lion, a young mountain lion who loses his home and essentially becomes a refugee, and about a community of refugees who happen to be animals.
Now, the history of cinema is that European directors also wrote their scripts, that auteur idea. American directors tended to do other people's scripts. But you've written 3 of the 5 films you've directed. Do you prefer that?
I like doing both. I mean, I started by just directing things that I wrote, but there's a lot of great writers, and ultimately I just want to tell great stories, and it's really great to have your a shock to your system as far as your point of view and recognizing your own biases and the stories that maybe you couldn't write but someone else could. So I just love great stories.
You also brought us Aziz Ansari's Master of None as well.
I was really fortunate to be able to direct the first couple episodes of Master of None, which was such a pleasure, a great New York show and just one of the funniest shows in years.
And Tom, now you're also writing?
I am. Well, yes.
A short story collection
coming
out?
I have a short story collection that will come out in September called Uncommon Type.
How long have you been writing fiction?
Well, versions of it for an awfully long time. At the office, as I like to call the world headquarters of Playtone, we sit around and all we do is examine stories and break them down and try to figure out how to better examine the theme that might be hinted at a piece of material. And doing it, I worked on the stories for the better part of 2.5 years. And without having to do it in a conference room with a bunch of other people around, with both a blessing and a curse.
You also should point out had the Presidential Medal of Freedom put around your neck by President Obama.
I mean, that was a big group. I mean,
who else was? Is that Michael Jordan, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar?
They were there.
Lorne Michaels,
Vin Scully, Grace Hopper, the Impossum and the Sully. There was Bill Gates. Everybody had educators. Everybody had this fabulous list of their accomplishments. And behind mine and Robert De Niro's, I'm happy to say, it just said one word.
Tom Hanks stars as Eamon Bailey in James Ponsell's film, The Circle. And it opens this Friday. It premieres at the Tribeca Film Festival tonight at 8:45. Thank you both so much for being on our show.
Well, thank you.
For more information, go to our website at wmyc.org/Lopate.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The promise of what omega-3 fatty acids can do for our health has created an industry worth billions. So 2 years ago, author and fisherman Paul Greenberg began a simple experiment to see if there was really something to it. He would eat only fish every day for a year and see if it improved his health. He joins us now to discuss his Frontline documentary called The Fish on My Plate, which explores how the omega-3 industry is just part of a larger growing demand for fish and poses tough questions about our ocean's health, fish farming, and the route seafood takes before it ends up on our tables. It airs locally tonight at 10 p.m. on WNET, and I'm very pleased it has brought Paul Greenberg back to our show. Welcome back.
Oh, thanks. Great to be here again, Leonard.
Where does the idea that omega-3 fatty acids should be eaten every day even come from?
Well, it goes back to two doctors from Denmark, Bang and Dyerberg, went up to Greenland in the early 70s, and they found an Inuit population that mostly ate seafood, seals as well as fish. They had extremely low rates of cardiovascular disease. And when they looked at their blood, when they spread now their blood samples, very high levels of omega-3.
So that's a study. Are there other studies that have been done? Anything contradict that?
Well, omega-3s are pushing up against aspirin as one of the most studied compounds on Earth. Close to 30,000 studies have been done, but there are different kinds of studies. The studies that were done on the Inuits were what are called observational studies, where you look at a population, you look what they're eating, and look at what their health is. But it's different from what is called the gold standard, which is a randomized control trial, where you're actually giving people something, giving other people placebos, and seeing what the effect
because
is.
Because the Inuit might very well have a genetic predisposition.
That is one supposition, and there was a doctor out of Berkeley who looked at that. But, you know, nevertheless, I already ate fish, and I always felt...
Well, you're a fisherman.
I'm a fisherman, and I always feel a little healthier when I'm eating fish. And I thought, well, if I feel a little healthier when I eat a little fish, why not eat a lot of fish?
What health metrics were you measuring in yourself?
So I was looking at blood pressure. I was looking at cholesterol. I was looking at triglycerides. Overall, I was also, you know, sort of passively checking my heart rate and looking at my weight as well.
And what did your doctor say about the experiment?
Well, as I say, I'm simultaneously working on a book called The Omega Principle, and as I say in the book, he gives all these sort of large questions of medical issues. He gives it sort of an Upper West Side Jewish shrug. And, you know, I think – and the other thing that he always says is there's so many metrics. You know, there's so many confounding factors that to look at just one thing is a little bit difficult to isolate.
Aren't there concerns about mercury when you're eating that much fish?
Yes, indeed there are. And – you know,
that wouldn't always have been the case. When did mercury become a problem?
It really started, well, there's always background mercury in the environment. Mercury does come out of underwater seeps and so forth, but a lot of it comes from burning coal. There are mercury seams within coal, and when we burn coal, it gets methylated, which means it can then be incorporated into our body tissues. So I would say it's really started to rise in the 40s, 50s, 60s. It's also, we've seen extreme mercury poisoning in case of, like, you've heard of Minamata disease, right? Mm-hmm. Remember, there was that bay in Japan where a company called the Shizu Corporation really seriously polluted a lot of people and their birth defects and so forth. The mercury issues we're dealing with are of a more chronic nature and not so acutely visible.
So why not just take omega-3 fatty acid pills?
There are people who do that. And that is one of the sort of subtle arguments of the supplement industry. But the other counter argument I've come across, even Dr. Bang, who I interviewed for my book, I'm sorry, Dr. Dyerberg, who I've interviewed for my book, and is in the Frontline doc, he says that, well, you know, omega-3s are a fat. They're a lipid. And if you take them out of context without other fats, their bioavailability, that is how you use them, might be significantly decreased. So popping a fish oil pill in the morning may not get into your body the way you want it to get in.
So it's probably best to eat to get that through fish. Some fish have more omega-3 than others. Are Americans eating more fish?
They are. We've upped our intake per capita by about a pound. But America's a paradox when it comes to fish because we only eat about 15 pounds of fish per person per year. That's well below the global average of 45 pounds and well below the Japanese and Chinese, which are in the hundreds of pounds. So there's that. But on the other hand, we have the second biggest seafood footprint in the world. So individually, we're not eating a lot, but as a country, we're actually a huge impact upon the ocean.
Because we have such a large coastline.
91% of our seafood is imported.
So. Well, we'll get to that in a moment. Wasn't always thus.
No,
but aren't more people in the middle of the country eating seafood than in the past? No. In the past, it was pretty much people along the coastlines.
That's true. And it really, yes, the average American now thinks of salmon as something that they would include in their rotating for dinner. And a lot of that is actually because of fish farming. You know, 50 years ago, everything we ate was wild, and now half of what we eat is farmed.
Well, if you're going to get an inexpensive meal at a restaurant, it's likely they're going to offer you chicken and salmon.
That's right. And interestingly enough, though, if you decide, like I did for a year, only to eat fish, when you choose the salmon, when you choose the fish, the stuff that comes along with the salmon is always healthier. So that's another confounding factor. You know, so when you eat fish, you get the healthy stuff on the side.
You said that much of it does not come from our own coastlines, although tuna does, and the Japanese tend to buy a lot of Atlantic tuna that is caught here and ship it to Japan. So we're not the only ones who are importing our fish.
It's a big jumble which fish goes where. I mean, as I say, 90% of the seafood that we eat as Americans is coming from other countries. But we also export 30% of what we catch. So we're, you know, it's fish literally passing each other in ships in the night.
And why does tuna have higher levels of mercury than other fish? Do they just absorb it differently?
No, they are highly predatory. They really sit atop the predatory food chain. So it's kind of like every time, every rung you go up on the food chain, the next rung up absorbs all the mercury of the previous rung. So by the time you get to the top, like a big tuna, it's got the mercury legacy of everything below it.
Tuna is the favorite fish of sushi. If I eat it raw, is the mercury going to be the same as if I cook it?
Absolutely the same. I mean, there is some maybe some leaching off that goes off if you broil it, but you know, mercury is going to be there no matter which way you eat it.
My guest is Paul Greenberg. We're talking about a documentary that he's made that we'll be showing tonight at 10 p.m. on PBS stations. It's called The Fish on My Plate. Where does most of the fish that Americans eat come from?
A large part of it is coming from Southeast Asia. A lot of it coming from farms in Vietnam, Thailand, China. And a huge reason why so much of it is imported is because the number one most consumed seafood in America is shrimp. Something like 4 pounds out of the 15 pounds the average American consumes. And all of that, or most of that, is grown in Southeast Asia.
But you also have a little sequence with somebody who tells you that she's Chinese,
yeah,
that American caught fish is shipped to China, frozen. It's processed in China and then shipped back to the United States for consumption. Shouldn't we just be doing that ourselves?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that sequence kind of floored me. And the idea that fish have to be frozen whole in America, shipped to China, defrosted, boned, and sent back to us double frozen, it's really galling. But we don't have the processing capability anymore. We've really downsized our fish processing capability. We also don't seem to want to pay for the labor involved in doing that. You know, China, it's much cheaper to do it, to have Chinese labor do it for us. But personally, I would like to see that stuff all returned to the United States.
And when we import fish, are we sure that we're getting the fish that we think we're getting?
You know, there's a lot of mislabeling going on there. Some of the more extreme studies, like something that Oceana did, found something like 40% of seafood in restaurants was mislabeled. There's all sorts of issues. There's, you know, the other issue is something like 20% of the wild seafood that comes into our plates is actually coming out of illegal fisheries, pirate fishing, producing fish for us.
Have we overfished to the point where we need to have an aquaculture industry?
It depends where you which countries you're talking about. The United States has actually gotten its fisheries management really together in the last 30 years and to the point where we're one of the best managed wild fishery nations in the world. But globally speaking, there is no question that we need aquaculture. We catch about 80 to 90 million metric tons a year of fish globally. That's the equivalent of the human weight of China taken out of the sea every year. But we consume as a species, as humans, 150 million tons of seafood per year. So if you had no aquaculture, everyone's seafood supply would immediately get cut in half.
Well, I was surprised that Norway has pioneered aquaculture, especially with salmon.
Yep.
Norway has a lot of coastline. Yep. I'm assuming it has an awful lot of wild fish swimming around the country. So how did they wind up in aquaculture?
They start, you know, a couple of brothers in a fjord in Hitra started growing salmon in a pen and feeding them herring. And they found that they could actually grow salmon outside of salmon season and they could make a mint doing it. And it just the idea caught on, and it was just extremely profitable, and it's still profitable. If you go to Norway today, everybody, all these salmon farmers are driving around in Teslas, you know, making money hand over fist. It's one of the most profitable food industries there is right now.
But it's also controversial, you point out. There are activists who are opposed, and there's in the film you have a boat from a fish farm blocking the path of the activist boat that you were on.
Yeah, we went with this guy, Kurt Ottekald, to look at a fish farm. And the idea is that he had a little submersible that he puts on the bottom and drives it underneath the fish farm to see the poop. And then he has a theater set up in his boat to watch it. I called it Master Poop Theater. And which, you know, it was pretty ingenious. But we actually had the fish farmers were actually revving their engines, trying to push us back because they did not want us in their face.
And what are they afraid that you're going to find? That there's a lot of poop on the bottom of the ocean? There would be poop on the ocean floor anyway, wouldn't there?
I think this is maximum poop, like, you know, like the millennial poop. No, I mean, there's a lot of waste thrown off by salmon farms. There are people that argue it can be diluted by the ocean. But, you know, I think salmon farms have come under a lot of scrutiny from environmentalists, sometimes unfairly. And I think they're gearing up to, they just don't want any scandal or any attention. They just want to say, everything's fine. Let's just do it as we're doing it.
Isn't part of the problem also that you have to feed the salmon in these farms?
Absolutely. And that's one of the things.
You mentioned herring, but a lot of them just eat pellets.
They eat pellets, but the pellets ultimately come back to wild fish. And one of the things we do in the Frontline Dock is we go to Peru, which, who knew, is the site of the largest fishery in the world. It's this thing called Peruvian anchoveta. And sometimes they catch more Peruvian anchoveta than all fish caught in United States waters. And 99% of it is ground up, turned into meal and oil, and fed now to Atlantic salmon, farm salmon.
You're talking about anchovies.
They're anchovies, yeah. Yes. And you could put them on a pizza.
A lot of people love anchovies.
Yeah. How do you feel about anchovies?
We have a regular visitor to our show, Melissa Clark, who uh-huh. would put anchovies into any recipe.
I'm with her. I mean, anchovies became – so for my year of eating seafood, anchovies were an integral part of it. And, you know, I put them in pasta sauces, on toast. It's a great fish.
So does it matter where the anchovies come from? Because in Europe, where they're prized, they generally come from the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
Are Peruvian anchovies different?
Well, you know – if you've ever been to the Mediterranean, everything always seems better in the Mediterranean. But I will say this from a sustainability point of view, the Mediterranean is one of the most overfished places in the world, whereas Peru still has millions and millions of metric tons available. But as I say, 99% of it doesn't get fed to humans. So I say, eat the Peruvian anchovies. Don't boil it down into fish.
So the Peruvian locals don't eat the anchovies.
They don't eat it. They don't eat it. And partly because they can never get their hands on it. It gets swept up by these industrial vessels, goes right into the factories, and they don't even put them on ice when they catch them. They keep them out in the hot and baking sun because they don't. Doesn't matter. They're just going to boil them down for ingredients for aqua feed later.
And you show actual tons being pulled out of the sea.
Yeah.
Now, is there any danger of overfishing anchovies?
Yes. I mean, anything can be overfished. Look, you have
krill.
To look.
Isn't krill what you don't deal with here?
But I do in the book. I did go to Antarctica, but that's later.
Krill is now in short supply, and it's causing a problem for the penguins.
Well, look, it's all relative. There's actually 500 million metric tons of krill out there. There's a lot of anchoveta still out there. But you have to look at the whole thing like a bank account, right? You have a principal that you don't want to spend, but the interest you can spend. Fisheries management, when it's good, only takes the interest. When it's bad, it goes into the principal.
But the anchovies are natural food source for other fish absolutely. Off the Peruvian coast, sea bass, for example.
Yep.
So does overfishing them or fishing them in these quantities affect the wild fish in the area?
It can. It can, especially the year that we went was a strong El Nino year. So in an El Nino year, the whole ocean gets a lot less productive. And so the amount you can catch goes way down. And so there was a big controversy when we were there. Were they going to open the fishery? Were they going to keep it closed to protect the fish? In the end, they decided to open the fishery. And that was a source of a huge conflict between the environmental community and the fishing community.
What about the Peruvian government?
Peruvian government went with the fishery in the end. And they said, you know, they had reduced the quota enough, they thought, to ensure the safety of the fishery. Only time will tell. But, you know, the thing that I end that particular section on in the film is that, you know, we had a very similar thing happen in Cannery Row in Monterey. In 1940s, we had a huge fishery for sardines in Cannery Row. An El Nino event hit, And they kept fishing, and the fishery really hit the skids. And surprise, surprise, all that fishing effort, all the boats and factories, they got moved to Peru.
My guest is Paul Greenberg, whose latest project is a documentary called The Fish on My Plate, the follow-up to his best-selling book, Four Fish and American Catch. It will be broadcast tonight at 10 on PBS stations, WNET here in New York. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Paul Greenberg. His latest project is a film called The Fish on My Plate, which airs tonight at 10 p.m. on WNET and covers a wide range of things. You didn't want to just talk about omega-3 fatty acids. You didn't want to just talk about aquaculture. You didn't want to talk about fishing, the oceans in general, the fact that that all sorts of other things, mollusks have disappeared, even though they are so important to keeping our waters clean. All of these things, are they all tied together?
Yeah, it's very hard to plot a course through the world of the ocean that the average viewer can kind of understand. But I think what we did is we took the omega-3 as the spine. Okay, you know, here's this guy, he's going to eat fish all year, but let's see what kind of spurs off of that main railway we can find to do that journey. So we do journey into the questions of wild fishery management. We do go into the questions around aquaculture. We do go, as you mentioned, into mollusks. We look at the one of the most sustainable seafoods there are, which is mussels and kelp.
And New York used to be one of the great sources of oysters.
Yep.
And now pretty much gone. It kept our waters in better condition and supposedly helped us against storms like Sandy.
That's right. You know, the average oyster filters 40 gallons of water per day. So imagine when we had trillions and trillions of oysters, it used to turn off the entire water column of New York Harbor every 2 weeks. So it was a really, really incredible system that we've lost. And we could get back. I mean, there are pilot projects all up and down the coast. I actually have an op-ed in the Times today talking about how there'd been they're now threatening 17% cuts to NOAA, but one of the big things that NOAA has done is to encourage shellfish growing in this country, and it's really on the rise right now.
Let's talk a bit more about NOAA and its role in, most people associate it with climate change and the atmosphere, because atmosphere is the A of NOAA,
But O is the ocean.
Now, how important is climate change to this whole conversation?
Is
there such a thing as climate change?
Yes, there's definitely a thing of climate change. I've seen it in my own fishing in my own backyard. I mean, used to be you would go to the Gulf of Maine to catch cod. And now you go to the Gulf of Maine and you catch black sea bass, which really are from Virginia or from mid-Atlantic. But getting back to the issues around NOAA, you know, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is huge, oversees the National Marine Fisheries Service, which manages our fisheries. And now there's 17% budget cuts being threatened against this agency that keeps our fisheries viable. So I really think that they're interconnected in a way. You know, a healthy climate equals healthy ocean equals healthy fisheries, which equals healthy people.
What work does NOAA do when it comes to combating fish fraud?
They do a lot in terms of investigating. They do a lot in terms of trying to represent the very fact that so much fish is imported by pushing and promoting the idea of American caught fish.
So since we're also talking about bringing jobs back to the United States, would cutting the NOAA budget in a way be counterproductive?
Absolutely. Well, particularly as regards aquaculture or fish farming, fish and shellfish farming, right now we are 17th in the world in world aquaculture production, behind Myanmar and Malaysia. At the same time, it's the fastest growing food system on the planet. And if we were to develop a viable aquaculture system, we could really create a lot of jobs.
Well, you show a wide range of aquaculture approaches.
Mm-hmm.
From Norway having one approach, Alaska having another approach. There are even people who do some of it inland.
Yep.
Are there better ones and worse ones?
Well, certainly farming shellfish, mollusks, and clams, mussels, oysters, and kelp, things that actually get their food from filtering the water, that's an A+. Next up, I would say probably growing. If you got fish out of the ocean so that they weren't pooping into the ocean and polluting the ocean, if you could get that sort of aquaculture on land, that would probably be a pretty good thing. If you're going to keep them in the ocean, there are different ranges of things that you can do. And in the film, we do look at sort of the classic industrial model, but then we go to the Arctic Circle and see a pretty radical departure from that.
In which they actually send a baby salmon out into the ocean, so they become kind of wild fish at the same time that they're also aquaculture?
Well, so that's Alaska. So in the Alaskan model, they don't actually technically do aquaculture. They supplement their wild fish with hatchery-raised fish that they release into the ocean. They go out to sea and they come back. They're not actually putting them in a net pen.
They come back because salmon always come back to where they were spawned?
They always come back. It's like, you know, tourists to Florida or something like that. But they always come back, and they've got them imprinted on these bays where there aren't even actually rivers where they could spawn. And so they're literally creating a cycle just for fishermen.
So wouldn't that be the best approach? Why doesn't everybody do that?
Well, not everybody has the resources to create hatcheries. Not everybody has a pristine ecosystem like Alaska, where if you put in more fish fry, more juveniles, they will actually have the room to migrate and feed. I would say, though, also in Alaska, it's not an entirely uncontroversial process. When you do supplement a wild stock, there are some people that worry that you're overloading the carrying capacity of the environment.
Many of these fish farms are rather large, but you also explore options and alternatives to large fish farms. Mm-hmm. And you went to a smaller fish farm that's trying to work more sustainably. What did you find there?
So, yeah, that was up in Kvaroy near the Arctic Circle. And what they were doing was they weren't cramming as many fish into their pens. But interestingly, they weren't using chemicals to get rid of things like sea lice, parasites, and so forth.
Let's talk about sea lice after you finish your sentence.
Yeah, yeah. So, and they were using a special kind of feed where they weren't using wild fish to create the feed. It was just overall a much more balanced kind of system.
I didn't know about sea lice until I saw this film.
Well, I'm glad.
But it looks like it's a real problem.
Yeah.
Were they always there?
Sea lice naturally exist in the environment. They're basically like a little parasite that swims around, attaches to a fish, and sucks out its blood. When they're hopefully not having your morning croissant over this. But when you're in the wild, a few sea lice here and there, that's to be expected. When you create these confined animal feeding operations like a salmon farm, they pull in the parasites from around, and so that when wild salmon migrate past the salmon farm, they can get the parasites on them in unnatural numbers and suffer.
What happens when one of the salmon that comes out of the farm escapes? Does it become a wild salmon?
You know, it's another issue. The salmon in the farms have been selectively bred for many generations, and so they are substantially different from the wild population. The worry is when they escape, they can interbreed with wild populations, dilute and weaken that strain, or even displace the wild fish entirely in the rivers where they would go to spawn.
I'm speaking with Paul Greenberg. His latest project is a documentary that's being broadcast tonight at 10 p.m. on PBS stations. It's called The Fish on My Plate. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I remember years ago talking about farmed salmon being dyed to look like it was wild salmon because they don't swim around all that much. They don't develop their muscles, and so they don't develop that deep red color that we're used to.
So the red color comes from what they eat. It comes from krill and little crustaceans that have that pink-red pigment. What they do on salmon farms is they put the pigment into the feed. If you didn't do that, then farmed salmon would actually be sort of gray or white in color.
Now, we're talking mostly about salmon. Mm-hmm. Is salmon the favorite of people who fish farm?
Well, it's certainly the favorite fish in the United States. Right now, farm salmon, or salmon in general, just passed canned tuna as America's most popular fish. And that does drive people to want to farm it because you get top dollar for the most popular fish.
But you also mentioned pollock in mm-hmm. your op-ed piece today.
Yeah. Well, so that's the fourth most popular seafood. That is not farmed. It's entirely wild. It comes from Alaska, walleye, Alaska pollock, and it's actually the fish in your filet-o-fish sandwich. So, you know, the mosaic of what Americans eat right now is really intertwined. You have salmon, which is coming to us mostly farmed, and then you have pollock, which is mostly wild, and then you have shrimp, which is a mixture of both. So it's very confusing to know what's wild and what's farmed at this point.
And am I just being elitist when I think that I should only eat the stuff that's wild?
Well, I think you are maybe need to update your perceptions a bit, because farming, when it first started, was a little bit you know, over the top. In the early days of fish farming, it could take as many as 6 pounds of wild fish to produce a single pound of salmon. That's come down below 2 to 1. And I do believe the farmers have gotten better. I myself do eat farmed salmon, but I often choose wild, though, not for an elitist reason. I choose wild salmon because wild salmon really require a pristine, clean environment without a lot of mining development and so forth. So I feel like a vote for wild salmon on your plate is a vote for a clean environment.
What about other kinds of fish that are popular in other parts of the world?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in Asia, for example, there's a much higher emphasis on things like carp. Carp is actually, if you were to look at what is the most widely farmed fish in the world, it would be carp. That's because in Asia, they don't have this aversion to bones. Here in America, we like to have a nice, big, thick piece of boneless fish.
I remember when porgy was really popular in New York restaurants because porgy is a local fish, mm-hmm. but it has a lot of bones and you don't see it much anymore. It's a great fish.
It's a great fish. You can catch it locally. What I find the most interesting thing about porgies are, you know, it's a local fish that I always caught as a kid. But remember a few years ago, out of nowhere, you started to see dorade on the menu, orata. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's basically a porgy, but it's farmed in the Mediterranean. And it just appeared out of nowhere when people finally cracked the code on how to farm it. And I remember I went to this restaurant and I saw this, what is this, dorade? So I ordered the dorade and it came and I looked at it and I said, that's a porgy. You know, I can get that for $2 in Chinatown. So we are not always so well schooled in understanding what are the options available to us.
And then there's the matter of genetically engineering the mm-hmm. fish. GMOs are controversial in plants,
yep.
in our vegetables.
Yep.
Is it a controversial issue when we talk about fish?
Hugely controversial. The FDA just approved the Aqua Bounty genetically modified salmon. So this was after much, much controversy, after over 20 years of fighting about it. You know, the difference between that GMO vegetable that you're talking about and GMO fish is the GMO fish swims and it can get out. In a way that I think plants can't.
So, and then again, it can interbreed with normal fish. And how serious would that present?
So in fairness to the genetically modified salmon, it is 99% sterile, or 99% of the individuals do seem to be coming from sterilized females, and it's not going to be an issue. Nevertheless, there is that small, tiny percentage of possible risk. And, you know, the idea is that they're going to farm this salmon outside of the ocean in closed tanks. But on the other hand, once that genetic material gets out, what if the Chinese were to start farming in it in open ocean net pens? It becomes a risk and a concern.
A number of listeners have asked about your thoughts about tilapia.
Well, it is, you know, tilapia is from just an eco-biometric point of view, very sustainable. It goes from an egg to an adult in 9 months, which is like double the speed of a salmon. The main ecological problem with tilapia is that they're extremely invasive. If they get out and the water is warm enough so that it doesn't fall below 60 degrees centigrade, they will take over whatever fresh water they happen to have escaped into.
But if you want to do some fish farming in your own backyard and you had enough space, tilapia would be the fish?
Well, that's the garbage pail aquaculture project fish. I've lectured at a number of different high schools who, after reading my books, get excited about aquaculture, and tilapia is extremely adaptable. So, you know, and it is a fish of very much that will, I think, be the kind of fish that will feed developing countries. I think it's fine on the plate. It's very neutral, but nutritionally, it's more or less like a chicken.
When I go to the store,
yeah.
Forget about the supermarket. I'm always afraid to buy fish in the supermarket. Mm-hmm. But if I go to a fish store, mm-hmm. what should I be looking for?
Well, there are a couple of things to think in mind. First of all, I will always go for the mollusks, the bivalves, the mussels, clams, oysters, always a good choice. Second, if you're going to go for salmon.
And not shrimp?
Shrimp is not my first choice, just because on the farmed level, shrimp are responsible for huge amounts of mangrove forest destruction. And on the wild level, they have a huge amount of what's called bycatch. That's unintentionally killed stuff when you're trawling for shrimp. And it's usually more than 2 to 1, more than 2 pounds of wild stuff killed for every pound of shrimp that you bring in.
But you also point out that there are others, other mollusks that give us a lot more omega-3 than shrimp.
Right. Well, shrimp's a crustacean, not a mollusk.
Oh.
Sorry.
Yes, sorry.
The fish
right.
guy in me has to insist.
No, you're
they're,
right.
They're both treif, but But no, mussels have the highest omega-3 of all of the mollusks. So I would always go with those. But as far as throughout the rest of the fish market, major point, if you're going to buy salmon and it's not June, July, and August and you want wild salmon, go right to the freezer section. Because if you're buying wild salmon outside of June, July, and August, it's already been frozen. Places like many supermarkets I've seen will put out a big fillet, seemingly fresh wild salmon in October, November. Mm-hmm. That's been defrosted. So go to the wild section, go to the frozen section and get the wild salmon out of season there.
The film ends with you finding out whether or not eating omega-3 fatty acids for a year has improved your health. Should we reveal what you learned, or would that be the spoiler? Because it's kind of the mystery of the movie.
Yeah, I'm going to leave it as a spoiler. I will say that it has left me with many, many questions going forward. Questions about how I should organize my diet in the future. How do you organize yourself so that you can keep getting the benefit of omega-3s without getting the detriment of mercury? How do you create this sort of ideal diet where the right proportion of fish is in your diet so that you're not affecting negative things and supporting positive things?
Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Oh, my pleasure, Leonard. Anytime.
Paul Greenberg, The Fish on My Plate airs tonight at 10 on WNET. There's also a new book in the works.
Yes, The Omega Principle, coming out in July of 2018.
Climb every mountain, ford every stream, follow.
Listing all of the honors Barbara Streisand has been awarded during her amazing career could take me quite a while. She's won 2 Oscars, 5 Emmys, 10 Golden Globes, 8 Grammys, plus 2 Special Grammys, a Special Tony Award, 2 Cable Ace Awards, as well as the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the American Film Institute's Lifetime Achievement Award, the National Endowment of the Arts Medal, 3 Peabody Awards, and the French Legion d'Honneur. There are more, but I'll stop there. And did I mention she also acts, writes, directs, composes, photographs, and sings? In fact, she will be performing 2 rare concerts in the New York area under the title Barbara Encore, The Music, The Memories, The Magic. It's at the Nassau Coliseum on Thursday, May 4th, and then at Brooklyn's Barclays Center on Saturday, May 6th. It is my great honor to welcome Barbara Streisand to our show now.
Hi.
You also have a
Thank
recent.
Thank you very much.
You have a recent album, Encore Movie Partners Sing Broadway, an anthology of duets that you did with a whole bunch of people. Isn't that something like your 35th studio album, not counting all the live albums and soundtracks?
You know, I never remember how many I've done. I'm sorry. I thought I made 60 albums, but what is it, 35 studio albums?
Yeah,
I think that's separating
it.
The soundtracks.
And
probably, I'd have to look myself up to, keep up with these numbers.
At a certain point, you just stop keeping track, I imagine.
That's right. I'd call somebody and say, well, how many did I do?
You've also had 52 gold albums, 31 platinum albums, 13 multi-platinum albums. Billboard announced that you're the best-selling female recording artist in history and the only recording artist to have a number one release in 6 consecutive decades. Wow. So how do you...
Actually, with Encore, I'm told that it is... my manager, Marty Ehrlichman, of 53 years, told me that that became the 7th decade.
Oh.
But who's counting? No. You know what I mean?
How did you choose the songs and the duet partners for the album?
Well, I keep a list of songs that I love and would love to sing, There are so many I still haven't sung with all those albums. So when it comes time to do a new album, I look at my lists and my A&R man looks at the lists and the songs I've mentioned over the years and ideas, that he's had and... We come together, because I remember the Tony Newley he brought me another song, something called Feeling Good. And I said, I've always loved that song, Who Can I Turn To? Mm-hmm. And with that, we found Tony's original vocal. And he was a good friend of mine. I knew him well, 1969, 1970. And it's just a great thing for me, you know, as his friend, to do this duet with him. Then all the other people I've called, you know, who I admire, like Hugh Jackman and Anne Hathaway and Melissa McCarthy, I just call them up and ask if they want to sing with me. And everyone, you know, professionals and really talented people are so easy to work with. It's a myth that somehow the bigger star you are, the more difficult you are. It's actually the opposite, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, you did anything you can do with Melissa McCarthy. Would you consider doing something with Sean Spicer in the future?
I will do nothing with Sean Spicer.
She does the best Sean Spicer, don't you think?
Oh, my God. That was hysterical. Absolutely hysterical. I wish she were running the press office, you know? Melissa.
Uh-huh.
But what can you do?
I mean,
that was unbelievable.
So you mentioned Tony Newley wanting to do something that he had done. How do you wind up choosing things like Climb Every Mountain with Jamie Foxx or Any Moment Now with Hugh Jackman?
Well, Any Moment Now was a song by my dear friend Marvin Hamlisch, you know,
mm-hmm.
and who was my buddy since I was 19. No, I was 21. He was 19. When I met him, I adored him. He was so funny, so delicious, so warm, loving, and gifted, you know. So what I used to say about Marvin is that he was the one who was sent out for coffee. Not only did he play the piano at rehearsals, but he had to do the coffee run. And I didn't drink coffee, so he brought me chocolate donuts, and I shall always love him. But it was a song that I heard about from a show that was a flop. And when I heard it, I thought, oh, my God. It actually gave me the idea of doing this album, Encore, which is integrating dialogue into the music. So it's as if you're watching a scene from a Broadway play. And yeah, that's why I had to use, you know, wonderful actors to play with me,
mm-hmm.
and who could sing. And so the first idea that I had was that it was to sing that song with Hugh Jackman about a dysfunctional couple and their thoughts and then their solos and then their duet together. So that was really exciting because I had to go. I went to see Hugh in a Broadway play. It was not a musical. And I told him the idea, and I gave him the song and some dialogue I had quickly written. And he said yes, you know. And it was probably a year later that we actually recorded it. But it gave me the whole thread of the whole album. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. You also recorded The Best Thing That Ever Happened with Alec Baldwin. And judging from your response to the Sean Spicer question, I'm not going to ask you whether you want to do a duet with the president.
That one I did with Jimmy Fallon playing the president on his TV show. I don't know if you saw it. What did we sing? We sang some song, but I can't remember mm-hmm. what it was. Alec was perfect because it was a New York Sondheim kind of song, and I just thought Alec would be perfect for it. That was before he did these Trump things, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And he's really funny, God, and he's a wonderful, wonderful actor and a lovely guy. We had a lot of fun doing this album.
Will you be performing some of these songs in the upcoming concerts?
Yeah, I actually do Who Can I Turn To? Because we have film of Tony singing. so we'll be able to see it on my television show. You can see me doing the duet with Jamie, which won't be out till December.
But people can see you on the 4th and the 6th. On the 4th,
yeah.
You'll be at Barclays Center, and the 4th, you'll be at the Nassau Coliseum. That's a Thursday. And then
right. On
Saturday, the 6th, you will be at Barclays Center.
Right.
I'm speaking with Barbara Streisand, who doesn't tour a lot. In fact, won't your concert at the Nassau Coliseum be your first performance on Long Island since 1963?
Yes, sir. 1963, what was it called, the Lido Beach Club or something?
I don't know, I know that the Coliseum has changed a lot since that time. They just have renovated it.
I heard it's
beautiful.
That
part of the appeal?
Yeah. I mean, it's exciting. You know, my experience with Long Island was, since I was brought up in Brooklyn, when some of the families I knew got a little bit more money, they all moved to Long Island. Long Island, to me, was like Zanzibar, you know? I never really went out of Brooklyn. I don't think I was in Queens, you know, visited Queens, except to drive through coming from upstate New York or something. It is funny how small a place is, you know, when you're growing up and you don't go outside of that parameter. So Long Island was kind of a fancy place for me, so it'll be fun to play there.
When I was growing up in Brooklyn, we called it Long Island.
That's right, Long Island. Yes. Oh, so you're from Brooklyn, too?
Yeah. Where did you grow up in Brooklyn?
Well, when I was a baby, I guess until I was maybe eight, I lived in Williamsburg on Pulaski Street.
Mm-hmm. I'm from Williamsburg.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
With those overhead trains that they're still there, too?
I lived next to the elevated trains. When the trains went by and people asked who would live in that place, it was my family.
That was you?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so funny. So you heard that noise all night long? Mm-hmm.
When the trains didn't run, I'd wake up wondering what went wrong.
Exactly. I mean, you get used to what you have, you know? I mean, we were a family of five. You know, we had one little bathroom. That's what we were used to. I mean, to me, to this day, you know, I have such a beautiful bathroom today. It's like I look at it, it looks like the size of my living room in Brooklyn.
And when you left home, you moved to Manhattan?
I kept wanting my mother to move, but I was going to acting school, and I had a job in town. When I graduated high school in 3.5 years, at 16, I had to get a job. So I would go into, I got an apartment. That's what I did. I worked as a clerk, you know, like licking envelopes, and then I was a telephone operator there. And I used to practice all my accents, answer the phone as a French person, as an Italian, you know, Spanish, whatever. I had fun. But then I got fired. And that wasn't so much fun because my rent, I had to pay with my girlfriend, Susan Dworkiewicz, from high school. Our rent was $100, so it's $50 each, you know, and I made $45.
And why were you fired?
Well, they said they were downsizing, but I'm not sure that was the truth, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's because I was doing too many accents on the telephone. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, I was wondering about acoustics, getting back to the Coliseum, which has been refurbished, mm-hmm. and now Barclays Center, which is pretty new. Is it important to choose venues where everything is just right, the acoustics, the sound system, the management?
No.
No?
No.
Why did you quit touring for so long then?
I don't like live performances. I've always had a bit of stage fright. Well, I didn't have stage fright when I was 18 till I was about 22. And then it sort of frightened. Oh, I know what it was. Of course, I forgot my words in front of 150,000 people at Central Park.
Ella Fitzgerald didn't mind when that happened.
I know. She was, you know, much more, I don't know, it didn't frighten her, and it doesn't frighten a lot of singers I've talked to that forget words and make them up. For me, it was traumatic. I remember it. It was a traumatic moment to go blank, and I wasn't charming and cute about it, you know. And it just stopped me from performing for 27 years. I didn't sing and charge. I only did it for free, you know, for fundraisers. That's all.
And what brought you back?
What brought me back was I saw Liza Minnelli sing in a living room, and I was a guest, and I thought, my God, look how she gets up, sings in front of these people with the lights on. I have to have blackness when I sing, so these arenas give me the blackness. I have to go, I can't perform. I am very uncomfortable performing live. This tour, I've been told that people say I'm the most at ease. I don't know how they tell that, but, and in a sense I am. I'm the most grateful, you know, I'm grateful that people still come to see me.
Oh, Barbara. So. Of course they still come to see you, but I was wondering about the stage fright. You began as an actress, and if I remember mm-hmm. correctly, the first yeah. play you were in was with Joan Rivers?
Oh, God. That was a, I wouldn't, yeah, it was like off Broadway in an apartment in some loft, and the show was called Driftwood. I played the leader of a gang of thieves, and she was Joan Malinsky at the time. She hadn't changed her name yet. And I had an egg salad sandwich before I went on, and I had a throw up before going on the stage. So I've never liked live performing. That's why I love making movies and making records, because it's, you know, you don't have to worry about how you look, what you're wearing, you know. It's just like, just, it's very easy to do.
When did
but
you...
When you're,
mm-hmm, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was just saying, you know, it's, you're singing in a fancy dress and have to wear some heels, you know. It's all strange to me, but I do it every once in a while because I love collecting art, and it's a way for me to pay for it mm-hmm. and also put money into my foundation, which is something that's very important to me.
Do you want to talk a bit about the Streisand Foundation? When did you start it?
You know, actually, I became very interested in climate change, and that was in 1989. I had done this concert in my backyard. I think it was called One Voice, and it raised money for the Democrats, and they were able to take over Congress, the Senate, and it was such a great feeling because it was after Chernobyl, and I got so frightened by nuclear power. And that fire that wouldn't burn out, do you remember?
Mm-hmm.
It was so scary to me that...
That area is still devastated.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be devastated for a long, long time. And it just made me want to do something, you know, to whatever I could do in my small way to bring attention to the subject and to raise money. And so the first chair I ever gave, endowed, was to a scientist called Michael Oppenheimer for the Environmental Defense Fund, and that was in 1989. And then, you know, I just like to use my funds to endow. My father was a teacher. My father was a scholar. And so I endow universities to study subjects that I'm interested in.
You must be inundated
like
with requests.
Well, yeah, I get inundated, but I'm very interested, as you probably know, in women's heart disease. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. Women are still kind of second-class citizens. And even in medical research, so that over the last 50 years, research about women was done on men. I've just been lobbying the NIH a couple of times to use female rats in the labs. How can you do research about women's heart disease, you know, on male mice? You have to use female mice. Because when I said, why don't you use females? Well, they're more expensive. Why are they more expensive? Well, they have hormones. That's right, duh. Because they have hormones, you have to use female, even, you know, mice, to understand. We have a different physiology. We have different plumbing. We have babies. We can feed babies. We are different. We have different size hearts. Different. We have a different microvascular system, smaller arteries. And it just bothers me that it's so unfair to women, you know?
You funded the Women's Heart Center at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles, which was named after you. Are they doing their research specifically on women?
Oh, God, yes. It's called the Women's Heart Center.
Well, they could be still using male rats.
No, I don't think so.
Uh-huh.
No, I don't think so. It's, you know, women are still so underestimated. It's incredible to watch, you know, even this last election with Hillary, the kind of the strong woman, the powerful woman, the educated woman, the experienced woman being thought of as the other, you know, or too elite or too educated or it's very, very odd to me. And it was heartbreaking for her to lose, you know?
Well, she's claiming that one of the reasons is misogyny. You agree?
Totally. I've been writing about it for a long, long time. I gave a speech after I won some award at Women in Film for Yentl. I talked about women against women and the jealousy and the competitiveness and women not trusting other women and not supporting them, really. You saw that in the film industry, even, you know?
And why do you think in the United States, England's already had two female prime ministers, the prime minister of Germany is a woman. We've seen prime ministers, prime ministers all over Asia, for example, and in Africa.
Why not the United States, which
is the most enlightened country in that regard in the world?
We are a younger country, you know? In a sense. And when I was making Yentl in London, I had the best time, the most supportive crew. And I thought, why? And it's because the monarchy is a woman, right? She's a queen. She's in power. At the time, Margaret Thatcher was prime minister. That's power. So they had no problem with little old me, you see?
Mm-hmm.
When I came to the United States, that was a different thing, a different perspective. It was like, oh, you're a woman directing this movie and you're in it and, you know, all kinds of
Well, you went further with Yentl. You produced, directed, and wrote the script for Yentl as well as starring in the film.
Co-wrote the script. Yes, I did. Because I had a vision of what it should be, and I thought, you know, give me the chance to do it. You have to remember it took 14 years for me to get to that place in England to make that movie. 14 years of trying to convince people that, you know, being an actress doesn't make you not capable of handling finances and, you know, the strength of whatever. The power in women has always been suspect. Strong women have always been suspect, don't you think?
I don't know. I'm not.
In this country?
I'm not intimidated by strong women. If the woman has something to say, What's the difference? But I guess it's true for a lot of people. I'm speaking with Barbra Streisand, who will be performing two concerts in the New York area under the title Barbra, the Encore, the Music, the Memories, the Magic, at the Nassau Coliseum on Thursday, May 4th, and then at Brooklyn's Barclays Center on Saturday, May 6th. You talked about not liking to perform before audiences, but when did you start singing professionally? Didn't you do it? Did you do it in nightclubs? Did you start doing it in Broadway musicals?
When I was 18, I started to sing professionally in nightclubs because I couldn't get a job as an actress. And I thought, okay, I'll enter a talent contest. If I win, at least I could get free meals, you know, free dinners. They had great London broil, I remember. And, you know, that was a way to use myself as an actress through my songs. I always approached a song from an acting point of view, you know. One song I could sing as if I were playing Juliet. Another song I could do certain exercises I learned in acting class, so it kept me interested. I mean, thank God I was born with a good voice, you know, so I could do that. But
had you been singing all along?
Singing all along. I sang on the stoops of Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was 5 and 6, we used to harmonize, I remember.
Yeah, do-up time.
I sang in the hallways, you know, because it had good sound in the hallway of my apartment building. But I wanted to be an actress. You know, I wanted to play Shakespeare and Chekhov and Ibsen. But nobody would give me a chance, really.
But so. you wound up doing acting in I Can Get It For You Wholesale. Of course, you sang as well. Funny Girl. Funny Girl was your big breakthrough,
19,
wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Jerry Robbins, I had auditioned for him several times because he didn't know whether I could carry the dramatic arc of the character, you know. As a woman with two children, I was 21. And, that to me was a great opportunity because I had to act in those shows. I mean, to be on Broadway was, you know, pretty great.
Mm.
So that's what I did.
And then Funny Girl was your first major film role. You got you your first Oscar. And then there were more films, The Way We Were, which really allowed you to show off your acting chops. A Star is Born.
Mm-hmm.
Yentl, Prince of Tides. So movies are your favorite medium?
Oh, yeah. Movies and recording. I love recording. Again, because it's a private thing, you know? And yet, as I say, this is my, you know, I don't want to say like, you know, it's the last tour because it is my last tour, but I don't want to say it. But, I mean, I may, you know, sing here and there, but I'm never going to prepare something for 3 months again. I'm writing a book now. I'm writing my memoir, which is very, very difficult. It's like my attitude has been there, done that. Who wants to write about it? But
I think people would want to read it.
Well, I hope so, but because I go into a lot of detail. I'm writing the chapter on Yentl now, as a matter of fact. It's already like 100 pages. You know, trying to get there, getting it made, and then making it. So it's difficult to go back. Who wants to go back? I like to go forward. You know, I like to be in the present and then think about the future. So this is very difficult, but it's very hard to get movies made today.
Even though you have your own production company?
Well, unfortunately, I'm kind of lazy in that way. I had a wonderful partner, Sis Corman, who now has dementia. And so I never really, I'm not that ambitious, you know, I'm a combination of both. When I was younger, I was ambitious, but now I kind of like to lay low. You know, I don't go to openings. I don't like I don't really like the limelight kind of thing. I don't. And that was a rude awakening, you know, as a young girl, and you want to be recognized and become a star and all that, and then you get stardom. And it was disappointing to me.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think there are a lot of people who wish they could be in your place. Your website describes
I'm sure there
you
is.
As actress, singer, director, writer, composer, producer, designer, author, photographer, and activist. You see yourself in that order?
God, I don't think of myself as all those things. I don't know. I just do my projects and what I'm interested in, and I don't really think in those terms. I just do what I do. I believe in, you know, women's rights and children's rights and human rights, and
well, I know you also support artists and filmmakers who do socially responsible work. You recently made a video in support of a film called The Promise, which is about the Armenian genocide.
That's right.
So
yeah, that's right.
You felt it was important to support that cause?
Yeah. I think genocide anywhere is horrible. And, you know, after hearing Sean Spicer sort of talk about the Holocaust in the way he did, it's shocking. And this film is great, The Promise. People should really go see it because it's very moving. And it's like, you know, I love movies that have sort of a love story and then the whole back of it is political. It's like The Way We Were, mm-hmm. in a sense, you know? And that's The Way We Were, is that's when I decided I want to be a director during that movie. And then it took many years to become a director, believe me.
And Robert Redford also went on to direct. But what projects do you hope to do in the future? You sound like you're thinking of going into semi-retirement.
Well, I do want to direct movies and make albums. So it's just that I don't want to do, personal appearances. I don't want to tour. That's what I don't want to do. But I have two projects, one about the young Catherine the Great and how she became Empress and her smarts, you know, a woman way ahead of her time. So I love projects about strong women. My other one is about Margaret Bourke White and her passion for work in a time when, again, women were supposed to be, you know, on a man's arm and not be so ambitious.
And she's one of the great photographers of her time.
That's right. And I've been trying to get this made for many, many years. Still can't seem to do it.
You're also a photographer. I guess you must feel some kind of kinship.
Well, I just appreciate her. You know, I appreciate and I love her growth pattern. You know, a woman who photographed architecture and buildings and rotating wheels and inanimate objects and how she came to be interested in faces and, you know, the human element. And it's part of a love story again, and yet, and how difficult it is to have a career and also a marriage.
Now, you said that you would prefer not to be doing any more live performance, but we will have the rare opportunity to see you in live performance coming up really soon. At the Nassau Coliseum, May 4th, and Barclays Center, May 6th.
That's right.
And I'm so pleased that you are returning to Brooklyn.
Well, it's where I came from, you know. It's my roots. So it seemed proper to do my last kind of two concerts in Brooklyn and Long Island, you know.
Can I invite you to come back to talk about the memoir when it's published?
Oh, sure, but don't hold your breath. I've been doing it for 2 years already, because I don't do it every day, because I have other things that I have to do, but I don't know when it's going to come out.
Meanwhile, we have Barbara, the encore, the music, the memories, the magic at the Nassau Coliseum and the Barclays Center.
It's called Encore, not the Encore.
I'm sorry.
It's Encore.
Encore.
And then the magic, the whatever the hell it is, you know, the music, the. Yeah, I've just finished editing the television show. That's what I've been doing. And that's fun. See, I love that. I love editing because it's, again, it's a private thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you can work very specifically. The live experience is, as I say, also, I'm the most grateful I've ever felt, you know, with the audience coming and their coming to see me, and that's very heartwarming to me. So it'll be nice to do these two in May.
And Barbara, thank you so much for talking on our show.
Oh, you're so welcome. You're so welcome. Another Brooklynite. That was fun.
Barbara Streisand, the concert, Barbara Encore, the music, the memories, the magic. I got it right that time. At the Nassau Coliseum, Thursday, May 4th, Brooklyn's Barclays Center.
Thank you.
Saturday, May 6th.
I hope I see you there.
I'm going to be there.
Oh, good, 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 good. Come and say hello.
Hi, Melissa?
Oh, wow. Barbara Streisand.
Streisand, like sand on the beach, soft S.
Right, sorry. What are you doing here?
I'm here to see the director. He cast me as the lead in his new movie.
He cast me as the lead in his new
movie.
That's
impossible.
Yeah? Well, we'll see.
Really?
Any part you can play, I can play better.
No, I can play any part better than you.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
Any laugh you can get, I can get bigger.
I can get any laugh as big as you.
With one look.
With a glance.
Till they cry.
With their pants.
Till they roar.
Till they soar, I'll get more.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.